Welcome to Conversations with Consequences, now on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Ashley McGuire.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And we are thrilled to have back on the show a dear friend, Mary Eberstadt, who is a prolific Catholic writer, author of several influential books. Many of them were prophetic and ahead of their time. I know Adam and Eve After the Pill was prophetic about the impact on the culture of the birth control pill. Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics, was prophetic about what happens to the culture and society when people searching for identity don't find it in their families anymore. And of course, How the West Really Lost God is another great read. Her books and essays have been widely translated. Mary is a senior research fellow at the Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, and she holds the Panula Chair in Christian Culture at the Catholic Information Center. Welcome back to the show, Mary.
Thank you, Ashley and Betsy. Great to see you again.
So another way that you've been prophetic, unfortunately, is about the rise of anti-Semitism. And you have been speaking out about this and writing about it really before it took such a stronghold in our culture. And you were recently quoted again in a piece in the Free Press that came out just a few days ago called Inside the Christian Civil War Over Anti-Semitism. And you echoed sentiments and a quote that you quoted from Fulton Sheen in a piece you wrote a few years ago about the rise of anti-Semitism. And you quoted Sheen as saying, to be anti-Semitic is to be anti-Christian. Can you expound a bit on this?
Well, first, Ashley, I would like to say that I don't think anything is more shocking to Catholics who don't spend their lives online than the rise of anti-Semitism among tradition-minded Catholics. There is a very long tradition in the modern age, and not only in the modern age, of teachings against hatred, of teachings against hatred of Jewish people in particular. And in my writings, I have quoted many thinkers in addition to Venerable Fulton Sheen, among them Pope Benedict XVI and St. John Paul the Great, and many more. So the question is, why is this message about loving your Jewish brother not getting through to younger Catholics? And I think the answer is several. One, these are for the most part digital natives who are spending their lives online. They live in the ether. And of course, this all intensified during COVID. And so I think there is a sense of unreality there that Catholics who did not grow up with the internet just aren't used to. I think a second factor is that we live in a time of economic uncertainty. And history shows that whenever there are moments of uncertainty, people reach for scapegoats. And the Jews, being small in number relative to the rest of us, are one obvious scapegoat. So I think some of what's going on out there is scapegoating. And third, I think people need to be aware of what the Catholic tradition teaches. And that's why I keep speaking out about this, because unlike other areas of, say, theology or sociology, this is not a gray zone. The teaching is absolutely clear. And I think we have to insist on it, not only because the young Catholics who are engaging in anti-Semitism are wrong, but because they are imperiling their souls if we believe what the Catechism teaches.
So, Mary, you talked about the internet, which we're going to talk about more, but you and Rod Dreher note that this radicalization is driven by a meme culture and algorithms that appeal to black-pilled youth searching for an authentic identity. I'm as mystified as you are. My father fought in World War II. This whole thing is just unfathomable to me. So what is it about the internet culture that you think is really radicalizing? I think especially maybe young men, but maybe, you know, it's young men and women who in other areas are very traditional.
Well, a lot of study has been devoted to what being on the internet all the time is doing to us. It is making us anxious. It is also delivering dopamine hits. I think a fair analogy here is to compare anti-Semitism online to pornography online, because They're very similar phenomena in some ways. They deliver thrills, illicit thrills to people who really don't want to be caught at what they're doing online. And the irony here, Betsy, is that some of the young Catholics who understand that pornography is bad for them and who try to stay away from it, who buy software to keep it off their laptops and their phones, some of these are the very people who, when no one's in the room, are opening anti-Semitic websites and trading anti-Semitic memes around, not understanding that there's a connection there. So again, what I'm saying here is not at all, oh, kids today. I think kids today are facing things that no generation in history has had to face because of the internet. And what we want to do is educate them so that they realize where the dangers are. Because face it, we're Catholics. We believe that evil lurks in dark places, and online can be a pretty dark place.
In your piece for the Free Press, where the title of which is Why Anti-Semitism is Moral Pornography, you tease out how some people are hiding behind the idea that they're anti-war and using that as kind of a shield that's really actually shielding nascent anti-Semitism. Can you tease that out?
Yes, so nobody, no Catholic is being asked to sign on to whatever any foreign government does, or even what our government sometimes does. In other words, no one's being asked here to rubber stamp everything that the Israeli government does. But I do think there's a fair amount of bad faith. The problem is that Israel is held to a different standard than any other government. Scores of governments came into existence and nation states in the 20th century alone, and no other country is held to the standard that Israel is. So, what does it tell you when there's a constant double standard about what a country should or shouldn't do? It tells you that there is something hiding behind it. And what I'm saying is that anti-Zionism is often a masquerade for anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up because that seems to be the lingua franca that a lot of these people are using, is that I'm not anti-Semitic, I'm just anti-Zionism.
Well, you can tell the difference because, first of all, when people start talking about the Jews as if they are a monolith, that is a sign that they are stereotyping and scapegoating individuals. And when people use phrases like some popular podcasters use, say, Judaism is demonic, Zionism is demonic, I hate those people, those Christian Zionists. I mean, all of this language is indicative of something that is deeply unchristian. And I just wanted to read something that I came across this morning because it is Lent and because this dropped into my inbox. It is a quote. This is the central program of the Lenten season, to listen to the word of truth, to live, speak, and do the truth, and to reject lies that poison humanity and are the door to all evils. That was Pope Benedict XVI. And my point is that if anti-Semitism, swapping anti-Semitic memes, trash talking the Jews, is not an example of lies that poison humanity, it's hard to think of something that is. So we have right here in stark form in this single sentence, the struggle between what it is that the church teaches and what it is that some young Catholics are choosing to engage in.
In a piece that Ethics and Public Policy Center Ryan Anderson wrote, he mentions that young Catholics are turning to these radical fringes because they feel that the Catholicism they grew up was watered down. How do you respond to that?
Here is what I think is the heart of the problem and why some of us are so preoccupied with it. These young Catholic traditionalists are trying to be good, and they are embracing teachings that their boomer parents and others had a lot of trouble with. So, for example, generally speaking, this is the generation of Catholics that embraces Humanae Vitae and the disciplined teachings about sex and marriage and procreation. And that is wonderful. It's been wonderful to see that renaissance. The problem is It's the same generation that's letting itself be dragged into the mud with this kind of hatred or crypto hatred or whatever it is that some of them think they are feeling about Jews and Judaism.
So, there's this explosion of young people coming into the Catholic Church. I follow a Twitter handle, speaking of people spending too much time online, of a who is basically just documenting dioceses around the country and showing the percentage increase of people, young, mostly young people, they have coming into the church, and it's insane. I mean, we also had the priest on, the Dominican, who Fernando Mendoza brought his Heisman Trophy to, and he said they have something like a 300% increase in people coming into the church, and it's not, this predated Fernando Mendoza, faith in the spotlight. But are you at all concerned that there's a risk that this tidal wave of young Catholics might be, infused with some of this anti-Semitism and really kind of only exacerbate the problem?
No, I think we need every convert we can get. But I would say this, Ashley. So for 15 years, I have been writing about a coming revival of some kind in the Catholic Church in the United States. And the reasons were several. Because of my travels, it's been my privilege to see, for example, groups on campuses that didn't exist before. Catholic groups, Protestant groups. On my own alma mater of Cornell, there is a vibrant Catholic scene now that didn't used to exist. Fellowship of Catholic University students is all over the place. Thomistic circles is all over the place. And so it stood to reason that out of all of these seeds being planted, some good fruit would grow, right? And it has. And that's why this subject needs such attention, because if you didn't like that growth, say if you were on the other side, what would you be trying to do? You would be trying to drag all those young converts down. And I think that's part of what is going on here, is that we have to make some room for spiritual warfare and for understanding that not everybody likes the revival that is now bursting in young Catholic America. And these young Catholics need to be on their guard for that reason too, I think.
And they need, I think it's important to stress the need of formation. I'm thinking of Father Panula, whose namesake is the chair of your one of your titles. And I'll never forget a conversation I had with him where I was a new Catholic and I still believed in the rapture because I was raised in a very evangelical home. And I'll never forget him kind of looking at me and winking, and he said, "A little more formation for you." And seeing some of these, we won't name names, but some of these recent converts to the faith, I totally agree with you. We need every convert we can get, but we also need to stress the importance of ongoing formation. And you've just done an incredible job of laying out in multiple pieces and speeches the richness that the church has to offer on its deep thinking on the matter of our relationship with the Jewish people.
I would like to add also that I am hopeful for this generation of Catholics because, first of all, some of what's happening here is that they are being hoodwinked by influencers, right? People are making bank off the eyeballs that they're pulling onto their anti-Semitic junk. And this generation of digital natives can see through that kind of ploy when it comes to other stuff, right? They're very skeptical of big pharma. They're very skeptical of big farm. They know that they're being exploited on the internet. All they have to do is wise up about this particular exploitation. And that's one reason that I'm hopeful. And the other reason is that, again, the tradition-minded young Catholics are already doing the hard stuff, right? They're trying to live the life that Jesus laid down, that the disciples complained about, that involves very strict rules around things that everybody knows about. And they're walking the walk. So I don't think it should be so hard to get them to recognize and repudiate this kind of online anti-Semitism.
So, do you think the answer is to to fight back with memes that show the truth or that quote encyclicals, or, you know, how do you see practically, I mean, your things in like the free press are so eloquent, but I'm concerned that those people aren't reading those things, the people who need to, but hopefully people who are forming them. What are some practical things that you think about going forward with changing the narrative?
I don't personally think that fighting back with memes is the answer. I am of the view that there are some people who just shouldn't be online, and there are some subjects that shouldn't be memeable. For example, I don't even think that the Pope should have a Twitter account. So I don't think the fight necessarily is one there. I do think this is one case where we have to appeal to the clergy, because the converts are coming in through the clergy. They're getting some kind of formation. It may or may not be robust, but because that's the door through which they enter, this is a place where we need our priests and bishops and the rest of the hierarchy to take a stand and speak clearly to those young Catholics.
You mentioned in one of your pieces about the consortium that you were a part of with Franciscan University at Steubenville, thinking, is this really even necessary? And then being so glad that you were part of it, because it absolutely turned out to be necessary. What are some other upcoming resources or places for people, for our listeners, who would like to find out more or read on this? What is going on that we can direct people's attention to, that, you know, things you're a part of or things that you think are worthwhile in thinking and speaking out about this?
Yes, thank you, Ashley. I have written a number of pieces, an unexpectedly large number of pieces about this subject, and they can be found on my website, maryeberstadt.com. And as for the Coalition of Catholics Against Antisemitism, which is another resource, it has a mission statement. If you Google it, you can see the mission statement, and I believe you can see the hundreds of signatories, professors, journalists, other Catholics, who signed when this was launched in October 2023. If you had asked me 3 years ago whether all of this work was necessary, I'd have been baffled. And that was my first reaction when the Coalition of Catholics Against Antisemitism started and they asked me to come and give a speech. I said, do I really have to give a speech? I mean, isn't this stuff obvious? I'll help with the mission statement, but why go to all the trouble of a conference? Then October 7th happened, and the conference was weeks later. It's impossible to relay the gravity of that coincidence, but it goes to show that a lot more work is needed. I know there is a conference coming up at Benedictine College on this subject in April. I don't have any other details, but people who are concerned with this should just keep watching for signs, because I think they're going to have to abound.
Well, we can't thank you enough, Mary, for your prophetic witness and your unending courage in speaking out on basically every difficult topic and always being right about it. So thank you for your time speaking with us today on this very important topic, and we'll hope to have you back on again soon. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you, Ashley. Thank you, Betsy.
We'd like to take a moment to thank all of our loyal listeners who tune in each week to Conversations with Consequences. As you all know, the Catholic Association is everywhere. We were on TV to cover the conclave and the election of the new Pope. We're in print, we're online, and we're on social media. We've just launched a new Substack to expand our media presence and offer more great content from a Catholic perspective. We're on X, and now we're on Substack for Catholic Conversations with TCA, where we're featuring exciting new interviews, commentaries, videos, and more, featuring our four fellows, Ashley McGuire, Mary Fiorito, Lee Sneed, and Betsy Fentress. And we'll be having guest columnists each week as well. We hope you'll subscribe to our Substack. It's free. You'll find it at catholicassociation.com. www.substack.com, and we'd love for you to join us in our continuing Catholic conversations.
This is Ashley McGuire with Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. This Lent, I'm reflecting on G.K. Chesterton's quote about Lent. He said, "The night shall be as bright as day, dazzling is the night for me, and full of gladness." What a beautiful paradox, but what a wonderful way to think of Lent. It is a time of darkness, it is a time of longing, but it is also a time of beauty that shines brightly as we await the resurrection of our Lord and Savior.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences, where I am joined from Nigeria by our TCA resident chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry. Monsignor, tell us what's going on in Nigeria and why it's important for Catholics all over the world.
Well, I arrived earlier today here in Nigeria and arrived for a couple reasons. One, to be able to see where the real needs are for our brothers and sisters in Nigeria. Everybody's always asking and we're getting plenty of news, but some of it filtered through the secular news media. So I want to talk to the bishops myself. I want to see the situation on the ground. Second, I want to bring the encouragement of Catholics in the United States. Last year, Catholics in the U.S. through the Pontifical Mission Societies alone sent several million dollars here to help the church in Nigeria. But that's still, as generous as it is a drop in the bucket compared to what their needs are. As I've been talking to bishops since I got here, because I've been with them at their semi-annual plenary conference. Some of them come up to me with real situations that they have so many churches that need to be built. There's no money. The people in their particular part of the country are so poor, and sketching the what they think are possible solutions. So that's clearly part of it. But then one of the most important things is to bring the fruits of Nigerian Catholicism back to the United States. Mm-hmm. As I say, there are two things we really have to know about the church in Nigeria. Everything else just fills in the gap. Last year, about 8,000 Christians died in Nigeria. Many more were kidnapped. Others had their churches burned down. The church in Nigeria is a suffering church. There's no question about it. But at the same time, 93% of Nigerians go to Mass on Sunday. By far the highest rate in the world. The second highest is 74%. And those two things tell us a lot, that they are willing to practice their faith no matter what the cost is, because they recognize that Jesus Christ actually is real. He gave his life for them. And just like the first Christians, who were not afraid of martyrdom, because they know once you're martyred, you're in the Lord's presence forever, and that his resurrection matters. So you were able to see that type of intrepid faith in many ways. When I arrived at the airport, I arrived at 5:05 in the morning. There was a whole welcoming crew waiting for me, a whole bunch of school children from the Missionary Childhood Association, one of the four Pontifical Mission Societies that I helped to run in the U.S., all singing happy birthday to me because I arrived on my birthday. And then one of them had memorized this long speech to welcome me to the country, singing some of the gifts of Nigeria, having obviously studied a little bit about me and knowing my background and saying, "You're going to love this about Nigeria and that about Nigeria." It was really touching. And again, 5:00 in the morning, and these girls get up in order to be able to sing to a total stranger. And they're not really thinking like, who's dragging me out of bed? I mean, they know that the faith has got to be shared. They know that the faith starts with hospitality. Those who receive you receive me and receive the one who sent me, Jesus told us. And there they were singing up a storm. I've seen in the bishops' meetings some real forthright talk about situations that they need to be better at, in which lay people are telling bishops that they need them to be better bishops in area A, B, C, D, and E. And the bishops are likewise not sort of tiptoeing around the issues in which they need the lay people to be stronger. And I'm amazed when I see that type of stuff. It's respectful, but it's really direct. It's not bringing politeness to the level of abstraction, lest anybody be offended in the least way. But it's kind of straightforward right there. Here's the challenge. I know you can do it, but I need you to do it. And so it's been a real learning experience. Visited some seminaries here already. To see the extraordinary hope on every face, visited some Catholic schools in which you just see such gratitude to be able to learn. You know, in Nigeria, it's not required for you to go to school. And so you'll see various posters. I saw several of them these last couple of days, in which basically a third of girls in Nigeria don't go to school at all.
Mm.
And like they're growing up without an education. Those aren't generally Christian girls. It's generally Muslim girls who aren't getting that education. But it's shocking that you're seeing that type of approach to education. But the Catholic schools, the kids there, most of them are Catholic, but a few of them are not Catholic. They recognize what an incredible gift it is. The parishes are teeming. I'm looking ahead to going to the church that was bombed on Pentecost in 2023 and to see how resilient they are in rebuilding. It's a place where you get fortified in the faith, even though they lack a lot of the material resources that we can boast of in the church in the United States in such a way that we can help so many of the churches all across the globe. They are very rich in what matters most to God. And so it's fun to be around them.
Thank you so much for sharing your time in Nigeria, and we look forward to hearing more about it when you get home.
Okay, or maybe even in next week's program. So,
Okay.
Betsy, good to be with you. Count on my prayers from Nigeria. And
Hi, this is Betsy Fentress, co-host of Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. This Lent, I'd like to share with you some of my favorite books from my spiritual classics library. Today, I'd like to talk about How to Profit from Your Faults by Joseph Tissot. It's based on the writings of St. Francis de Sales, and boy, does it have some gems. Just listen to a few of these chapter headings. Our failings do not surprise us. Our faults do not upset us. Never be discouraged by our faults. Have you been discouraged by your faults? Do you find that you're confessing the same things over and over again? Pick up this book as a guide for you this Lent to help you grow. I promise it won't disappoint. Happy Lent.
Conversations with Consequences. Now on EWTN Radio, I'm your host, Ashley McGuire, and it's so fun to have the team together today as we launch the beginning of Lent. And I know that we were going to talk today about Senator Ben Sasse, who I think has really helped us with his witness as he is dying with stage 4 pancreatic cancer to reflect in a particular way on life and suffering. In the beginning of Lent. And I wanted to read a quote of his that he said recently that I found very profound. He said, "Death and dying aren't the same. The process of dying is still something to be lived." And I really think he's exemplifying that in the way that he's giving a very beautiful and profound Christian witness in his death. And it particularly resonates after having just read some of the really frightening data coming out of Canada about medical aid in dying and how more and more people are opting to just take their lives instead of living out and enduring that suffering at the very end. So that's just a takeaway that I've had from his witness. I don't know, what's struck all of you about his witness in these moments of suffering?
What I found especially compelling is just going off what you just said, Ashley, was the way his demeanor in the Hoover Institute interview. He's so down to earth, even down to the way he's dressing, the way he sort of, I mean, just says it as an aside. Oh, sorry, this is a wave of nausea. Like, oh, you'll need to understand if I'm sitting in a funny way because of the tumors on my spine. And while he draws from obviously deep, rich, like theological, biblical traditions about death and dying and mortality and everything, the way he talks about it is just so familiar that I think he exemplifies what he's talking about in terms of like being present in the now and not skipping ahead to the end or not acknowledging that he is dying, but that dying is something to be lived, like you said. It's remarkable, I think, the way he's able to carry himself right now and talk about that, and at the same time have a podcast on Monty Python. I just think it's such an incredibly beautiful witness, especially people who are in middle age, because I think we all think that, you know, death is what happens to old people, and not people with young children. And so he's bringing all of that and all that sort of fleshy reality like to the fore. And I think it's a real gift.
You know, it was very reminiscent for me
of the death of the late Cardinal Joseph Bernardin in Chicago, who died of pancreatic cancer as well, who was in his mid-60s when he did so. And his oncologist was a Dominican nun at Loyola's medical center. And I remember when he said the week that she came and she said to him, "You're going to die this week." And he wrote down a lot of notes, a beautiful book that became The Gift of Peace. And one of the very last things he did with his time on earth to redeem the time, which is something that Ben Sasse went back to multiple instances during his reflection there, was that he wrote to the Supreme Court about assisted suicide and said, "As someone who is so vulnerable now, I am begging you, do not do anything that would make assisted suicide or medical aid in dying or whatever you want to call it, that would make that available to people who are vulnerable, because you're never more vulnerable than when you're looking at the very end." And so just there's so much profundity in that interview, but also it's because it's through a lens of faith that I think that we find it so resonating. And you know, it reminds me of something my mother used to say: "I don't know what people without faith do."
Right. Well, last week I had the privilege of interviewing Dr. Lydia Dugdale, who has been a really outspoken medical ethicist and is herself a physician, about the assisted suicide bill, what they call it, medical aid in dying, the euphemism that just passed in New York. And so her book, The Art of Dying, is about the Ars Moriendi, which was really written by the Catholic Church and one of the councils in response to the bubonic plague, where people were in front of their family and death was everywhere. And so Ben Sasse said this quote in that same Hoover Institute interview that I thought was really applicable to what Lydia said. "Death is a wicked gift. I don't want it to happen, but we're mortals, and it seems like it's not sophisticated or modern or naive to pretend we're not mortals. It's true. And so you got to grapple with big questions. And this is not news to me that I had numbered days. It just became a more precise number. We all have numbered days. So, you know, what do you do with that?" And here he is, you know, getting on a podcast and laying it all bare for all of us to think about in our own lives.
I was thinking too how, again, going back to Lent, Lent is like a mini death. It's like a period where we die to some of our vices, and you feel the coming of the death of Jesus. And it's been interesting to see the way that Ben Sasse has used this time of actual death to reflect on things he wished he would have done, or habits or vices that he wished he would have let go of earlier. And one of the things that really caught my attention, because it was on a Sunday and I was driving from one baseball practice to another baseball practice and then rushing home and taking a kid to play practice, was his comments on the Sabbath. And he said, "If I had to do it over again, I would think a lot more intentionally about how to be more ambitious in my household and take the Lord's Day and the Sabbath more seriously than all the ways I was a workaholic for decades." And, you know, I think all of us can understand the struggle of trying to protect the Sabbath. And my husband literally just texted me the quote as I'm like driving from here to there to there. And so that, you know, I think he's, because death is so imminent for him, he's giving us lessons right now. He's telling us, giving us wisdom that it's worth reflecting on. That somebody who's running out of time is saying, "These are the things I wish I would have done better." And even though we're already, you know, well into Lent, several days into Lent, it's not too late to step back and say, "What are some of the ways that I can incorporate these wisdoms from somebody who's literally wishing that he could take back certain aspects of his life?" So I don't know if any of you had noticed other things that he had said in that vein about things he wished he would have done differently or better, or if that had caused any of you to reflect similarly. Well, actually, I felt very convicted about what he said about just being a father and being present in his home and being a guide and a resource and a role model, most importantly for his children, as well as his wife. And just as a mom, I felt very, you know, challenged by that. Like, when have I put,
things that at the end of the day really weren't that important in front of time with my children or something my child needed. And I thought something else I wanted to do was better. There is just something that everyone can take from this particular interview, and I've listened to it 2.5 times now. I feel like I pull away something new from it every time because, first of all, he was just laid bare everything, his soul, his heart, his mind. But then the interviewer himself, I think there was a lot of prayer that went into that interview before either of them started it, because this is something, you mark my words, people are going to be writing about and commenting on long after Ben Sasse is gone to be with the Lord.
One of the things that I thought was really curious was that he said that he probably should have been a football coach. He sort of starts the interview that way. And I was thinking, okay, because as I'm watching you, I'm thinking, what a loss for the Senate and for political leadership in the United States, because I love his ideas about educational reform. But I wished he had talked more about why he thinks he would have been better off just being a football coach.
Yeah, his dad was at University of
Yeah, he
Nebraska.
mentioned that.
And of course, he's from Nebraska, where football is just like
Right.
it's there's a lot, they don't have any professional sports teams, so the Nebraska football team is the thing. But he had such a brilliant head. I should not speaking of him in the past tense. He has his PhD in history at Yale from Yale because he loved to read books, and he said, "I wanted to go somewhere where I would have to read 100 books a month." And he talks at great length, or about how America doesn't read anymore. And I felt convicted by that as well, because I used to be a voracious reader. And he said, now we're all just, scrolling through Instagram looking for 2-minute clips to watch. And that's substituting for what used to be reading time. I'm like, oh, you don't say. Because, everybody, I think, used to have kind of a standard time when they read, whether it was before you went to bed or at lunchtime. I always carried a book with me on my lunch hour, and I hadn't really thought about it in that way, that those days are kind of gone now. And we need to find a new way to broaden people's, intellectual life, but also their spiritual life. And you often do that by reading.
Yeah, and I think that too, I often find my, I mean, I know Betsy does too. We both like the long form essays, but when you read them on your phone, you have all the other distractions of your phone there. So
Right.
even when I see, I'll save an article and be like, this is when I'm going to do it. I've got my tea or my coffee. This, I'm sitting in my special reading chair. I'm going to read this article on my phone, 25-minute read. And I'm interrupted the entire time. I mean, there's just no substitute for, I mean, I guess a Kindle without Wi-Fi isn't as a good substitute, but just holding a book in your hand and having that thing, having that just dedicated reading time. And I think that that goes back to what he was saying about the Sabbath. It's so easy, especially when you have jobs, and which so many of us do these days, after, especially after the pandemic, where we work from home and there's no separation of between like work hours and home hours because you're just home all the time. And then the weekend and weekdays kind of flow into each other too. And even during Lent, as Catholics, we're fasting, we're abstaining from meat on Fridays. It's easy to just sort of, just quickly remember, oh, I need to eat, I need to not eat meat today, and then sort of move on without there being any sort of reflection or just even something that's just marked for yourself or a family. And I think that I'm glad that Ben Sasse is here talking to us about this because it would hate it for us for it to happen for all of us to only have sort of this sort of date in mind where it's all going to be over that makes us realize that it's all running together and we're not making time to read books and we're not doing these things and the distraction is sort of like the main game
I have a
of our
friend
days.
who's a retired lawyer who teaches CCD at her parish, and she is charged with the confirmation class for the 8th graders. And there was some kind of like parental petition to it's normally after the family mass on Sunday mornings, and there's some kind of parental petition now to move the class to Wednesday afternoons because they have sports on Sunday mornings. And it used to be in the Catholic League, you did nothing before noon on Sunday. There could be a game Sunday afternoon, but nothing before noon on Sunday. And now the parents won't even come to, and some parishes caved and said, okay, we'll do it on Wednesday, thinking, we'll appease them in order, so we don't lose them completely. But sports has taken over Sundays. And this is where I think the church can learn so much from the Orthodox Jewish community, for which the Sabbath is sacrosanct, and there is so much, even Jews who have left their faith still will observe the Sabbath in many cases because of the way it gave them rest, but also that time with their family. I mean, my youngest is going off to college next year, and God willing, I just think, where did the time go? And everybody tells you that when you're a young mom, and Ashley, keep this in mind, and Lee, but you don't believe them because you're so tired all the time. And then you turn around and your last one's going to college. And Betsy, you're nodding your head. I think you know what I mean.
I do. I wanted to just make a shout out since we're talking about Sabbath. Abraham Heschel, the great rabbi, has an amazing book called Sabbath. And also Joseph Pieper's Leisure, the Basis of Culture. Those are two books that I have in my library that I really love. And I also just think that there's a lot of stuff I try not to do on Sundays, because if I don't stop, then I feel exactly what Lee said. All my days run together, shopping or cleaning, I just try to, especially on Sunday mornings, to just really slow down, gear down. Sometimes we'll have several couples we get together for brunch, or I just light a fire and pick a good book and sit by the fire.
Lee, you share a connection to Ben Sasse in that you both have degrees. He has a master's, but your undergraduate degree was from St. John's College, the Great Book School, which is a very unique program that does its own thing and follows its own course. Everybody reads the same great texts together. Do you see kind of imprints of that education in the way Ben Sasse talks about civilization, civic-mindedness, culture, reading? Do you see some familiar threads?
Yeah, it's funny because he was in the Graduate Institute, but he and I actually graduated the same year, so we overlapped. But I, of course, he wasn't Ben Sasse then. But yeah, of course, I mean, I do definitely. And in fact, I kept wondering. I mean, I kept expecting him to say something because I felt like his interlocutor, Peter, asked him so many great questions, and when he was answering them, I kept thinking he was going to refer back to his time at St. John's because. I mean, either, I don't know, chicken or egg, it was on my mind, or it reminded me of my time at St. John's College with the great books. But also, his talk in general and what we're talking about right now is making me think my husband's actually on a panel this coming weekend at the Santa Fe campus for the inauguration of the new Santa Fe president. And I'm going to go and listen to him. And then I thought, oh, that's going to be a long time to listen, even to my husband. And I suppose I can't really sneak and look at my phone because what if there are other Johnnies in the audience? And what if, I don't know what their culture is there now, but I can't imagine a world in which cell phones and apps and all that kind of thing fit into that when everyone, all you had to do for class was to bring your text and your notebook, no laptops, no anything like that. So that's really, I mean, of course, I thought more about myself than, I think the whole different, implications for society as a whole from reading books. But it did make me think about those days when the only thing that you needed were books and maybe a pencil.
And I believe he's also, he has spoken about tech. It's interesting because I think he's using technology really well. I mean, he made the announcement of his death on Twitter, in a long post, but it's like everything he's doing is very redemptive. And I just think, whether it's about technology or about personal relationships or the way he's speaking. I mean, he could use these moments. We talked about his interview with the Hoover Institution, and he touches on politics, but he doesn't use it for ad hominem attacks or to, fire final shots or, to take down narcissistic personalities that probably should be taken down. Instead, he uses it to reflect on what is the role of the politician and how can we help redeem American politics. And again, I've got to believe that his faith is what is grounding him in that way and giving him such a redemptive death. Because we've discussed together other examples, recent examples of people who've been forced to face their own mortality and how it's not necessarily marked by the same peace that he seems to have. And You mentioned Lee, just his demeanor, like he seems at peace, he's smiling. You would never know he was about to die, honestly.
What did you ladies think about his reference to the raising of Lazarus by Jesus and of Martha running out and saying, Lord, if you had been here, he would not have died? And he talks about that as her narcissistic moment, which I've never heard in any analysis of that scripture passage before. I always thought it showed her great faith in the Lord. Like, if you had been here, this wouldn't have happened because, you know, you could have healed him. But he said she immediately goes to her own comfort. So, well, you know, the most beautiful way to end this is how he talked about death is the final evil. It's the last thing you have to overcome. You go all through your life struggling and working and trying to overcome bad things that happen to your life. But death is the last one. And then you're done. And then you're with the Lord. And you don't need to worry about that anymore. It's your last big battle. And I love how he phrased that. It's not being Pollyannish about death and the pain and suffering he's having, but it has such hope in Christ and in the promises of a life that we're really being prepared to lead.
Well, that's a perfect note for us to end on. To watch the full interview of Ben Sasse on the podcast Uncommon Knowledge, visit hoover.org for more information. I think we can all say that we commend it to our listeners as great Lent listening to help us to deeper reflect on the themes of this Lent. So thank you, ladies. It was wonderful discussing this with you today.
Thank you, Ashley. Goodbye, ladies. Good to see you.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I am joined by our TCA chaplain, once again, Monsignor Roger Landry. And last week, Monsignor, we talked about the practices of prayer, fasting, and almsgiving for Lent. How can we expand that in a sort of a missionary spirit way throughout the season of Lent?
Well, thanks for asking. I've written an article for the National Catholic Register in which I explored that dimension. Now that I'm the National Director of the Pontifical Mission Societies, I'm rereading literally everything I've ever done within a missionary prism. And so I put some thought into how we would be able to become missionary disciples through our Lenten practices of prayer, fasting, and almsgiving. So Jesus called us, as you remember, on Ash Wednesday, when you pray, to pray. But we can particularly pray in a missionary manner. He told us to pray to the harvest master for laborers for his harvest. Mm. He himself, on Holy Thursday, as he was preparing for his sufferings on Good Friday, prayed for all those who would receive the gospel from the apostles. Jesus was praying first for laborers for his harvest and wanting us to join that prayer. But then he was specifically praying for us to recognize that that call to be harvesters is not just for other people, it's likewise for us. And so when we pray this Lent, wouldn't it be great for us to pray for those missionaries working in the 1,130 missionary dioceses and territories all across the globe? Wouldn't it be great for us to pray for those 82,500 seminarians who are in seminaries in missionary territories, who are preparing not just to serve their own people, but like so many have already experienced here in the States, to come far afield in order to buttress the situation of the church elsewhere. While they're very poor and still young in faith, they're responding just like so many of the first disciples of Jesus, and they want to share their treasure with us. And in a lot of our parishes, we need them. So we pray for them first. Second, we fast. Jesus says, when you fast, and the ultimate purpose of fasting is not just self-discipline. It's not certainly to lose weight, even though some of us aren't disappointed at that unintended but side effect that can happen when we really fast boldly during Lent. But the main reason for us to fast is to hunger for what God hungers. And what does God hunger for? He wants everyone to come to the knowledge of the truth. He wants everyone to come to salvation. He wants everyone to recognize the depth of his fatherly love. And this is one thing that all of us as Catholics are meant to bring to the world. That type of hunger. God's starving, we could say, for the 5 billion people who don't yet know his son Jesus to come to know him. And this is a time in which we recalibrate our hunger pains to the divine ones. Mm. And then the third is charity. Jesus says, when you give alms, don't do it for show, but do it so that your heavenly Father will reward you. Do it in alignment with where God the Father really wants generosity to go. He sent, of course, his son into the world as the first missionary to show the Father's love and to call them into a communion. He likewise sent the Holy Spirit to work with the early church to fulfill Jesus' missionary mission. How can we give alms in a way that spreads the faith? We've got a lot of causes closer to home. Our parish, our diocese, they spread the faith, but a lot of the times they're similarly doing a lot of the good in much needed corporate works of mercy. Sometimes when we're caring for those material needs, we can forget the needs of the soul. And so I'd urge everybody to say, like, how can I support the church's evangelization efforts? Maybe that's through the Augustine Institute. Maybe that's through Word on Fire or Ascension Press, all of whom are doing extraordinary good work. Maybe it's through Dynamic Catholic, likewise, a chief lay protagonist in doing this. But I'd particularly urge people to think about the international missions. When we give to U.S. apostolates, a lot of the times U.S. apostolates have other resources to be able to raise the money to do their beautiful work. But so many of the dioceses all across the world are suffering financially, and they don't have the capacity even to build a ramshod school because they're doing classes of catechesis underneath a palm tree just so that the people don't get sunburned during the day. Or as I was last year in Vietnam with these beautiful young Vietnamese sisters in an old tin boat on a filthy river, because that was the only place they had so that the kids wouldn't be rained on while they were studying. You know, a little bit or a lot can do enormous good in the missions. And so I just encourage everybody, as you're thinking about your alms, maybe ask the Lord in prayer, how can I support the extension of the treasure of my faith to the ends of the earth as your son Jesus came to start that whole process and then entrusted us to the church. And if anybody would like to do anything through the Pontifical Mission Societies that I run, I just urge you to go to pontificalmissions.org, look at ways to give, and figure out one way to give alms to your very needy but faithful brothers and sisters across the globe.
Thank you for all these practical suggestions for transforming our lives during Lent. We'd like to take a moment to thank all of our loyal listeners who tune in each week to Conversations with Consequences. As you all know, the Catholic Association is everywhere. We were on TV to cover the conclave and the election of the new pope. We're in print, we're online, and we're on social media. We've just launched a new Substack to expand our media presence and offer more great content from a Catholic perspective. We're on X, and now we're on Substack for Catholic Conversations with TCA, where we're featuring exciting new interviews, commentaries, videos, and more, featuring our four fellows, Ashley McGuire, Mary Fiorito, Lee Sneed, and Betsy Fentress. And we'll be having guest columnists each week as well. Just recently, Ashley shared some little-known facts about St. Carlo Acutis. Lee Sneed writes about her book on infertility, titled Infertile But Fruitful, and explains why she decided to write the book. So many people had responded to her columns and podcasts on her journey toward becoming an adoptive mother that she felt called to write a full-length book about it. In Lessons from the Turnaway Study, Mary Fiorito writes about mothers who wanted to abort their children initially, but were turned away for various reasons and had a very different take on their initial decision as years passed. And Betsy Fentress writes on hospitality and the will to live about a friend's father and a family friend with no relatives who were brought back to life by food, attention, and love. We hope you'll subscribe to our Substack. It's free. You'll find it at catholicassociation.substack.com.